Thank you for listening to the Shakespeare & Company podcast with me, Adam Biles, recorded in our writer's studio just above the bookshop at Kilometer Zero in Paris. If you enjoy these conversations, there are a few different ways you can support us. First of all, you can leave a rating right now in whatever podcast app you're using. The more ratings we get, the more likely it is that people will discover us. It only takes a few seconds and can really help spread the word. You can also buy books, gifts, and apparel from our online store, shakespeareandcompany.com, where you'll find our popular Year of Reading subscription, 12 books handpicked by our dedicated booksellers, shipped to you or a loved one wherever they are in the world. Finally, you can become a friend of Shakespeare & Company by joining the association we set up to get us through a difficult few years. Membership gives you access to exclusive online content, as well as other treats depending on the tier you choose. Find out more at friendsofshakespeareandcompany.com. I'll be back at the end, but until then, sit back and enjoy the Shakespeare & Company podcast. As we slouch into the middling decades of the 21st century, it's rare for a novel, that quintessential 19th century form, to feel transgressive. And yet The Appointment, Katerina Volkmer's debut, manages this with some distance to spare. How? In part, it's the themes. The novel's 100 or so pages cover a lot of ground, from family to fascism, sex robots to genocide, body horror to Bambi, and perhaps crucially, everything in between. However, it's not the themes alone, all of which have been tackled elsewhere, although perhaps never between the same two covers. No, it's also Volkmer's unbending commitment to the voice that makes The Appointment feel so radical. The spikiness but also freshness of the monologue, delivered in a surgery room to a doctor with his head buried between the narrator's legs. It's an astonishing, wild, thought-provoking read, and I'm very happy to say Katerina Volkmer joins me to discuss it today. Katerina, welcome to the Shakespeare & Company podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm so delighted you've been able to join us because the appointment was really one of the most surprising and, as I say, kind of refreshing reads I've had in the past year. I'd like to begin with this voice because I was thinking before the interview today of the last time that I felt an author so utterly committed to the voice. And when I say committed, I mean sort of, you know, not sort of having kind of little winks and nudges or little asides to kind of say to the reader, okay, we're all in this together, or you know what I'm doing, like giving the reader a bit of, let's say, breathing space outside the conceit of the voice. And the only one I could think of in any kind of recent times was American Psycho. Now, I mean, Your narrator in your book has very little to do with Patrick Bateman, but I just think there's something in that sort of commitment and that sort of realization of this voice, which it, at least in, to my mind, associated the two books. So I guess where I want to begin is with that voice. Could you talk a little bit about how it came to you? Was it through perhaps a reflection around some of the ideas, some of the themes that the novel tackles, or did the voice come to you in a sense kind of from nowhere, and then because of the character of that voice, the kind of the themes and the ideas of the novel were kind of drawn in?
It kind of came to me from nowhere. I've sort of stopped saying I started hearing the voice at some point because I feel like I always sound a bit insane when I say that. And it's a bit worrying. But really, I was working with a few sort of, well, shorter pieces. And they were sort of the moment when this voice was born. Mm-hmm. But really, it was just, for me, it was just a question of following her. And it was always the voice, but she was always already talking to Dr. Seligman in my head. Mm-hmm. Like she was always talking to someone. But it was quite a joyful experience, really, to follow her, but also to allow for her to make me and I think certain readers feel quite uncomfortable sometimes. Because I think there is an element that this voice makes people feel uncomfortable. But I feel quite happy when people tell me that it made them feel uncomfortable, because I think that's in a way one of the things that she's trying to achieve.
That's interesting, that sense of kind of discomfort, because I said in the introduction, like I described the novel as transgressive, and I think I want to be clear that sort of I don't see that the same as kind of shocking. Like I don't because you sometimes read novels where it's clear that the author is setting out to shock, and honestly, often that can be a little bit boring in a way, because you can see the kind of the mechanics of it. You could see how they're ramping up the kind of the horror or the subject matter to achieve a certain emotional effect, and it feels kind of quite manipulative. But that's not you don't get a sense that you were setting out to shock, and yet there's definitely a sense that you, with this voice, you wanted to dig, that you wanted to kind of get to the roots of something. Now, you said in your first answer that this sort of sometimes the voice would make you feel uncomfortable. So even was that sort of that process of digging, was that something which you set out to do, or was that something which the voice almost compelled you to do?
I think it almost compelled me to do it. I mean, I agree with you. I don't find it as shocking as, like, because I guess I'm also used to my own mind. But I think, yeah, what was interesting to me about the project was to just allow my mind to go to all these places and to not have any sort of barriers, be they sort of moral or, you know, I don't know, to just, because I think it's something that we don't do often enough, to kind of, you know, allow ourselves to go to the places where, even, you know, it might hurt, it might be uncomfortable, but I think it's on a personal level, but also on a sort of national level, because I guess that's something that the book is trying to do, is to combine those two aspects. I think it's important to go to these places. And on the whole, it was quite joyful to, you know, follow her, but yeah, sometimes it maybe took a bit of courage, but yeah, no, I think it's it was worthwhile, I think.
Yeah. So we've talked obviously about the sort of the voice in a little bit of an abstract way so far. But let's just talk a little bit about the narrator herself. Now I'm going to refer to her as the narrator throughout, because she's unnamed. We don't get to know what she's called, but we do get to know certain aspects of her life, kind of where she's coming from, her situation. But they are also things which are kind of sort of unveiled as the narrative progresses. So what I'm going to ask you to do is to introduce the narrator to our listeners as much as you think they should know before reading.
Yes, sure. So the narrator is a young German woman, and she's in London. She's lived in London for a few years. And the monologue takes place over a few hours, where she's with this doctor called Dr. Seligman. And he is busy between her legs. And whilst he's busy there, she tells him about, you know, her life, the things that worry her, the things that made her, you know, change country. And I quite like to think about it as a reflection on identity, but identity in a sort of physical sense, the identity that our body brings with it, and also identity in a national sense. And whether we can change it, that was one of the questions that sort of drove me, I guess. What can we change about ourselves? Are we able to change anything, really? And also what it means to be born into a body. It sounds very basic, but I was just like, what does that actually mean? Because it means so much, I think. And she's exploring all of these questions. Yeah.
And I think particularly that question of, I mean, you say she's a German woman in London, so she has left her country of birth behind, but it's clear from the very early pages that country, its history, its language, the family that she left behind there weigh very, very heavily on her thoughts and the way that she kind of apprehends the world. Is there something about the kind of the way that a German in London sort of apprehends history that is fundamentally different, do you think, to a British person in London? Like, are these, is there sort of a clash, not just on the sort of the facts that one talks about, but the very way in which one understands and sort of, yeah, apprehends and, let's say, processes events from the past?
I think they're very different. I mean, I always remember when I first moved here, which was a long time ago, I was so surprised that, it's a small detail, but that soldiers are referred to as heroes here, and mm-hmm. which in a German context, it's just unimaginable. And I think here people are maybe just about to start questioning some aspects of their history, but I always felt like generally people were quite comfortable with their past, which mm-hmm. For a German obviously is unless you're quite deranged, is not available as an option, mm-hmm. you know. But I think here, even though I think this country also has a very problematic history, I think it's only just beginning to maybe think about that. And so mm-hmm. I think it's always, if you, and I'm sure you can relate to this, it's if you live abroad, you will always have a different perspective, I think, mm-hmm. on your own country. And it's a perspective that will never go away again. You know, even if mm-hmm. I moved back to Germany now, I wouldn't be able to look at them with the same eyes. But I think here people, I mean, I haven't been to school here, but I get the feeling that they're raised with quite a lot of pride in their history, which mm-hmm. we aren't.
I think there's something also perhaps different about the sort of the level of knowledge with which people are sort of forced to engage with their history. I was recording an interview a month or so back now with Elif Shafak, and she said about people in Turkey, she said, like, people in Turkey are obsessed with Turkish history, but actually know very little about it. Mm. And that struck me as something that was kind of true about British people as well, that there's this sort of, you know, particularly when we look at the sort of the Brexit debate of the last few years, that there is sort of, there are certain historical events or moments which are very key to the national psyche. But at the same time, we are not sort of obliged, I guess, to have a sort of a detailed understanding of those events. And one thing that it struck me reading The Appointment and sort of getting to know the narrator was that sort of German people, perhaps more than any other nation, seem burdened with having to know the details of their history, like having to know the numbers, having to know the dates, having to know the people, and having that kind of constantly present and constantly kind of shaping the national psyche.
They do, because I guess it's also quite, in some ways, obviously, I think quite basic, because they lost the war, so they, you know, mm-hmm. so they had to engage with it in a different way. The thing that I'm wondering about is how, I don't even know if you can use that word, how successful the engagement was, because I think mm-hmm. it's flawed in many ways, and that they sometimes get quite smug because they think they did their bit and they've, you know, come to terms with their history and they've been denazified and all of that. Mm-hmm. And yet there are an awful lot of continuities of mm-hmm. of fascism, even of colonialism in Germany today, I think. And as you could see from our recent elections, it's a country that has a huge problem with neo-fascism. Mm-hmm. But still, yes, it's very different, because you and I'm in a strange way quite grateful for that, because you're not raised with any kind of, or I wasn't, patriotism. Like, for instance, in Britain, I find it so strange how often you see a British flag. Mm-hmm. If I see someone like with a German flag, I'm just like, oh my God, what are you doing? And there was I don't know when it was. There was a World Cup in Germany, I think, at some point, and people were waving a lot of flags, and that was the first time that they felt it was okay to do that. I still found it quite uncomfortable, but I think there are certain like symbols and things that aren't available to us. And here I find at the moment people, they struggle so much with things that I find obvious. Like when they took down some of those statues in connection with the Black Lives Matter movement, I was just like, yeah, statues come and go, you know, why is that such a big deal? And there are always these moments. It's also like when Notre Dame was on fire, for instance, and some French people I know, they were in tears. And I asked some of my German friends, I said, is there any building in Germany where you would feel like that? And they said, no, there isn't. You know, so it's a very...
That's really interesting.
Yeah, but we aren't. We don't form these kind of attachments, I think.
It's interesting what you said about the continuity as well, because, and I think it's a trap that I've fallen into already in this interview, like I've been referring to sort of German history, whereas in fact, what I'm really talking about is the Second World War and, you know, the rise of Hitler and the rise of fascism. And that's sort of essentially what we're talking about, a 15-year parentheses in a way in German history, which occupies such a weight in the understanding of Germany. I have the feeling within Germany itself, but also outside of Germany, that sort of the idea of history as a continuum, the idea that what happened during that time was caused by what came before and will have an effect on what came after, is almost something which is difficult for people to process. And as a result, and I think this feeds in to our narrator, it becomes something almost, it's sort of like almost like historical fetishism in a way. Like it's sort of, it gives people a certain sort of space in which they can move and they can react to, almost kind of protected from what came before and what came after.
Yes, and that's also what to me, partly what the sexy Hitler is about, which is something that caused a lot of outrage.
Just explain that to our listeners. Give them what the sexy Hitler is.
So the narrator at some point is obliged to go and see a therapist and to sort of get out of the therapy sessions. She comes up with sort of sexual fantasies about Hitler. And she has all these kind of quite elaborate fantasies about him. And which I think is one of the reasons why for so long nobody wanted to publish the book in Germany. And but for me, when I wrote it, it wasn't like a major part of the book. But it is for me to do with this obsession, because there is this obsession with Hitler. And then you always have German TV programs and they say, oh, yeah, and then Hitler invaded Poland. And I'm like, no, he didn't. You know, and there's people hide behind him as well, I think. And there is this, I was at a bookshop in London here the other day, and there were entire shelves dedicated to the man, entire bookshelves, you know. And there's definitely an obsession here with it as well, which I find quite strange. And I think all obsessions have a sexual element as well, which is one of these, I think, an example of what people might find uncomfortable. But I think there is that kind of, you know, part to it. So yeah, that's one of the roots of the sexy Hitler.
And I think also there's the counterpoint to that is, of course, the Holocaust as well, which has this sort of appropriately sort of enormous kind of cultural and historical weight. But again, particularly, I think culturally has become something almost kind of a cultural artifact, which kind of people feel that they can kind of respond to and manipulate in a way that it almost turns the Holocaust, the event itself, into a kind of a product. I remember at a reading in Paris many years ago, seeing Art Spiegelman talking about this, and he used a term which I think he coined, which he called it holo-kitsch.
Yeah,
we all know those kind of films which you sort of use the Holocaust almost as a way to sort of pull on the emotional heartstrings. And that seems to be something which sort of deeply troubles the narrator of the appointment.
Yes, because I think there's a whole industry attached to it these days. And I think I like the term holokitsch a lot, because I feel like it really captures something. And I think it makes it very hard to get to the bottom of the actual story. And I even found when I went to visit Auschwitz a few years ago, I found it so hard to actually connect to the place, because I feel like we've seen it a million times in films and, you know, TV shows, and it's such a like a sort of standard background by now, that when you go to the actual place, it becomes very hard to really find it in your heart, you know, and to really be present and be there. I found, and I think that's the effect that this kind of literature and these kind of films have. I think rather than bringing you closer to the actual thing, they remove you from it, I think. And I usually find these films quite unhelpful. And then by contrast, I went a few years ago as well. I went to Kiev to go and see the ravine and Babinya, which was the biggest massacre, I think, committed during the Third Reich. And there you've got nothing. You've got one monument, but you've got nothing. And I found that much more moving. And that was like the most haunting thing I've ever seen. But Auschwitz itself has, I mean, become some sort of Disneyland, you know? And, you know, you see people with their selfie sticks. You can now buy chocolate bars in Birkenau, and it's so it made it really difficult for me personally to really get to the place, you know.
And that's interesting, because firstly, you put me in mind of how I often hear people who visit Paris for the first time talking about the Mona Lisa. You know, they go to the Louvre, they queue up for hours, they go in and they come away. So that's kind of smaller than I expected. And that's a sort of, it is sort of this historically important artwork becomes something which you kind of, you're prevented from having a genuine connection to because of the familiarity with it. But with something like the Mona Lisa, that's sort of, in a sense, one could say inconsequential. Like there's no, it doesn't matter in any kind of grand sense whether you know, this painting by a long dead artist moves you or not. But the problem with the reaction, like you're talking about with when visiting Auschwitz, and that we find with our narrator, is that sort of, when she encounters Jewish people, it's almost like she's encountering a kind of, I think she says at a moment, sort of almost like a mythical, magical creature, because of the way that the Jewish people have been talked about and the Holocaust have been talked about and the way that she was brought up in this sort of German culture, which circumscribed the way in which one can talk about it, that she was prevented from having a sort of a genuine human connection with the Jewish people that she meets.
Yeah, and I think it's very true that a lot of German people, they would know what, you know, they would know what the Shoah is, but they wouldn't know what Yom Kippur is, for example. Mm-hmm. Right? They have no connection to contemporary Jewish life. And I think that's also this holokitsch, it gives you a very sort of set version of things, right? This is how it was, this is, you know, how history happened, and it doesn't really allow for different versions. And I think combined with that, you have this fear almost of engaging with contemporary Jewish life, which obviously exists in Germany today, but I don't think it's very visible, and people haven't really found a way yet to engage with it without being awkward. And I think what they sometimes do is they then put Jewish people on like a pedestal. And I think whenever you put people on a pedestal, you create an unhealthy relationship. And so I think, it sort of interested me what happened when you when you say, oh, I want to do it differently, I think the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin is ugly as hell. Like, you know, can we not? I do think it's ugly, and who wants to be remembered like that? And to find a different way and to try and have different conversations. And one of the outcomes of the novel that I'm very sort of grateful for is that I've had very interesting conversations with some of my Jewish readers in different countries, and they largely seem to really appreciate this, you know, because usually you don't get a German perspective so openly, I think, because people usually just say, oh, we're really sorry, you know, but they don't want to really let it get very close to them, I think. Mm-hmm. And I try to let it get very close to see what happens.
Yeah. And that's that idea about the pedestal, I think, is crucial in a way, because it's sort of the irony of putting anybody on a pedestal is it has an almost dehumanizing effect. Mm-hmm. And even though one might say, well, it's a question of sort of veneration, but even veneration is dehumanizing. It's sort of changing the level with which one engages with the subject.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, I think. And it also, it doesn't really allow for, I think, the other person's perspective very much, because you sort of have your version of them, you put them on your pedestal, and that's it. It kind of ends there, I think. And I think that's also why I was so interested in humor, because I think humor has this anarchic quality and has this possibility to open new spaces, because with humor you can get to people and they almost can't help it, they're gonna laugh, and then they, like, a lot of especially German readers have described this sensation whereby they laugh and then they take a moment and they say, oh my god, was I allowed to laugh about this, you know? Mm-hmm. Who's allowed to laugh about this? But they did, and I think in that moment you maybe create a possibility for a new way of looking at things and a new way of having this conversation.
I think one thing that struck me as particularly important about the book is the way it intertwines a lot of these issues. So of course, you know, we've talked a lot about already about the concept of history, but when you're a German of the sort of the generation of the narrator in this novel, history also means family, and so there's there's a moment where she says, you know, now that my grandfather is dead, we're left to grapple with the will of an old man who was a stranger to us. And there's this kind of idea that it's not, you know, history is not just something which happened on a sort of a national, on a kind of communal scale. It's also something which happened within families. And you see different ways of handling that. Like, one thing that people often joke about in France is that sort of everyone's grandparents was in the resistance. Yeah. And that's a sort of maybe a particularly disingenuous way to deal with it. But there is that implication that, yeah, when you talk with a German in their 30s today, for example, about the Second World War, you're not just talking about something their country was involved in, you're also talking about something that their grandparents may have participated in, and that their parents would have been very, very shaped by the process of dealing, you know, with the fallout of these actions. And that seems to be something, that sort of intertwining of those two concepts of sort of nation and national responsibility and family responsibility also seems to weigh quite heavily on the narrator and the appointment.
Yes, totally. That's one of the uncomfortable spaces, I think, because people, I think by now, are okay with saying, yes, the country was fascist and, you know, all of these terrible things happened. But I think it's still uncomfortable to admit to yourself that this is who you are and that this is where you're coming from, because the generation of your grandparents or great-grandparents will in some form have been involved in this. And I think it's also something special about my generation is that we are the last ones whose grandparents might still be alive. My grandparents are still alive, for instance. Mm-hmm. So I still have this this personal link, but which people who are 10, 15 years younger than me, they're not going to have this anymore. In terms of, I mean, the perpetrators and survivors, there are very few of them left. And I think that's one of the spaces where we need to go, but it's obviously uncomfortable to go there. And I'm also very interested in how the generation of our parents, but also, for instance, my grandmother, she would have been 15 when the war ended. So, you know, you could say, yes, she was young. She wouldn't have been a, sort of an active perpetrator herself. But of course, that generation was schooled under fascism. Mm-hmm. They had, you know, full indoctrination. And these people then, not my grandma personally, but they would run the country, right, at some point. Mm-hmm. And they are people who were schooled under fascism. These are things that that interest me. But yes, of course, this, I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but the ending of the book, you know, is this, she reveals who her great-grandfather actually was. And mm-hmm. In some ways, of course, the book is a form of a confession, I think. Mm-hmm. She speaks to someone who's Jewish, and she just tells him everything. She says, look, this mm-hmm. This is who I am, but this is also what I am. This is where I come from. And like my mother knew what I had written about. And she said, the first thing I did, I read the last two pages of the book, you know, because I wanted to know what you did. But of course it shapes families so much, I think, you know, and then, you know, you have to come to terms with that this is who your ancestors were. And that's also why there's a lot of irony in the book and, you know, what she's about to do to her body. But there's also something, there is this incredible German desire to be Jewish. I mean, people mm-hmm. would love, they would just, I think similar to you saying that the French people, they all would have loved to have been in the resistance. The discovering a sort of a Jewish grandmother is like striking gold, because then you suddenly, you know, you're not on the side of the perpetrators anymore. Then you can sort of you can be free from that. And there's quite, it sometimes takes on quite absurd dimensions in, mm-hmm. in Germany, this you know, desire to,
it's almost like there's a form of absolution that comes from discovering these ancestors.
Exactly that. And they always think it would have been easier, and I'm like, that's maybe not true, you know. But there's a huge debate in Germany over that, because of a writer who for a long time, you know, started every sentence by saying, as someone who's Jewish, and then another Jewish writer pointed out, you have a Jewish grandfather, you're technically not Jewish, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge debate over that at the moment. But I think at the heart of it is this desire to not be German, you know, or to be German but also Jewish. But I wonder if you do sometimes feel like Dr. Frankenstein, Dr. Seligman. Do you feel like you are creating monsters? I know that's how a lot of people feel about people like me. And I guess they are right in that we are staring in from the outside, that we see through their actions and know all about their little lies. And I think that's what makes us so ugly in their eyes. Knowledge makes people ugly, which is probably why we think that stupid people are easier to fuck or more fuckable. That they are not tainted by the obvious and, not unlike animals, much more in touch with their bodies. Officially, that's of course considered to be a bad thing. At least, that's what I gathered from my mother's complaints whenever I sat with my legs apart, my inability to sit properly because I never understood why there were two different ways of sitting for people with and without cocks. And I constantly got them wrong because I was forever confused by the fact that as a girl, you actually have less to hide than a man. But that was before I understood that a cock is some sort of a sword, an object of pride and comparison, whilst the vagina is something weak, something the owner could hardly be trusted with. Something that will always be a fuckie that can be raped and get pregnant and bring shame upon a house and a family. Something that needed protection without anyone ever questioning that need of protection. Why it was that streets weren't safe at night and that girls with short hair looked like boys and not the other way around. I always found all of that terribly confusing and often thought that maybe the cocks should be hidden instead, that we should ban the weapon and not the wound.
I want to pick up on something you said. You described the monologue as essentially a confessional. And you'd also mentioned that there was, you know, before the action of the book takes place, the narrator had been sent to a therapist, and in order to get out of the therapy, had kind of come up with this idea of sexy Hitler. And it struck me just as you said that. What I wonder what it was about the Dr. Seligman that allowed the narrator to confess to him rather than to the therapist. So obviously there's the fact that he's Jewish, but also is the fact that he's a doctor important, do you think, to the narrator? Like the fact that he is in some way sort of involved directly with the kind of the manipulation and alteration of her body. Do you think that in some way sort of liberates her to confess to him?
I think that's it, because he knows about her body, right? Mm-hmm. He knows about her sort of, because she sort of has two, secrets, if you want. And the secret of her past, that's the thing he doesn't know about that she's telling him about, but she's telling the reader about what's going on with her body, and he knows about that, and she doesn't have to explain that part of herself to him anymore. Mm-hmm. And I do believe in therapy and all of that, but I also think that it's very important to always take our physical reality into consideration as well. Mm-hmm. Like when I write, I usually start with the body. I'm like, okay, but we are here in the flesh, mm-hmm. No, not just in our minds. And I think that's part of her liberation, because even if ultimately her project of, you know, not trying not to be German anymore is maybe not going to be successful, I think she's still going to be liberated in some form, mm-hmm. I think.
One aspect where I think she is quite liberated already, and like before, again, before the monologue takes place, is on her, in her sexual life. And, you know, both in the way in which she has conducted it in the past, but also in the way that she is, I think, able to articulate it. Like there's a frankness and a sort of an acceptance of the inherent weirdness of sexuality and the fact that sort of so many factors from our life, from our family, from our history, from our circumstances will shape and will mold our sexuality in different ways. What do you think underlies that sort of that liberation? Is there sort of something a little bit that sort of, you know, when you do have to face up to certain of the sort of the great horrors of life and of history, the kind of the little sort of travails of sexuality seem almost inconsequential, and therefore you can sort of engage with them and handle them better?
Maybe it's the sexy Hitler that helped her. No, I think it's I think it's also because she obviously doesn't, you know, she doesn't really believe in like gender and the gender binary. And I think she has sort of taken that step to towards seeing the world differently. Into she sort of says, okay, but what if I don't want to do this? You know, what if I don't want to be a woman? You know, and I think with that comes great liberation, in a sense that she suddenly sees all the like ridiculous rules that govern your identity as a woman, you know. And I think she's thrown everything out of the window, basically, and I think that allows her to talk so openly, because I think there's always this sort of element of shame about if you want to talk about, I think especially a female body, if you want to talk about it so openly, I think there's always an element of shame, because ultimately I think women are very kind of, you know, constrained to sort of, they always still want to feel or be attractive, I think, because it's so ingrained that you kind of and I think a lot of these narratives where they are meant to be talking very openly, they still respect that boundary, right, where you where you still want to be a sort of an object of sexual desire. And I think this protagonist is almost craving the opposite. She's almost craving a sort of a body that's actually not very desirable in the eyes of the world. And it's been very interesting for me, because I'm sort of fortunate enough that the book will be put on stage in Italy, in Milan. And I spoke to the director, and he said, we're going to cast someone, but it's going to be so difficult to cast someone with the right body, because this isn't someone who's conventionally attractive. That's not someone who wants to be sexy, you know? And I think she, and I think maybe that's what allows her to be so free, because she's just like, no fucks given. she's kind of done with it. And and maybe that's what gives her that freedom.
But it wasn't always the case for her, and that's something we discover. Like, there's a moment where she says, you know, for years my feet alone made me feel like an ogre, and like she talks about how her mother had this idea about, you know the wobbling bums and things like that, that sort of was an absolute sort of an absolute crime, in a sense, a crime against sort of not just oneself but like society almost. And we get the sense that one of the ways that she was able to, you know, not give a fuck was through this kind of relationship, which is unpacked through the book with Kay as the person is as a person is named. And this was a character which is sort of a part of it, and I don't like to kind of second guess novelists or to sort of ask for more, because in a book particularly as kind of as sort of tightly written as The Appointment, I wouldn't have wanted necessarily more digressions. But I think Kay was the character that I guess in a sense left me most curious about, because you give us a certain amount about him, certain sort of episodic moments, but you don't give us, let's say, a fully kind of rounded character study of Kay. And I'm just curious, from the perspective as a writer, like how did you always know that we would just get glimpses of Kay, and that you would always kind of withhold a lot about him? Or was that just the way kind of the sort of the monologue unraveled as you were writing it?
No, I think it works in a way better if he remains this kind of slightly mysterious figure. And I guess his function in a way is to make her realize all these things about herself. But of course, there's also a lot of sadness in the book. And I think he also sort of represents her sadness. And of course, by not giving a fuck anymore, she also loses she gains, but she also loses a lot of things. Some people said they were disappointed because they thought it's disappointing that she falls in love. And I was like, no, but people fall in love, of course. Mm-hmm. And of course, he also represents this, I think, which is a big conflict for a lot of women who, you know, object to the patriarchy and object to all of these things, but they still find men attractive, right? Mm-hmm. It's like it's conflict, I think, that a lot of us sort of, you know, carry and have to deal with. And now I liked for Kay to stay sort of almost anonymous, but mm-hmm. Because I think it's more, it's just what she wants to reveal. And of course, mm-hmm. her relationship with him is also questionable mm-hmm. in some ways. And she reveals towards the end what happened there. Mm-hmm. And the relationship with the mother, I think, is also an important, for me, it's a very important kind of subplot in that mm-hmm. she almost liberates them both, I think. And I think the relationship between mothers and daughters is a very important pillar almost of the patriarchy, because that's where all these, you know, stereotypes and rules for female bodies get perpetuated. And you're right, she suffered from this for many years until she sort of broke out of it. Mm-hmm. And that's when she's, I think, ultimately forgiving her mother, because she realizes that it wasn't really her mother's fault. So,
One thing, kind of resting with Kay for a moment is, I want to talk about the kind of the sort of the sexual mechanics in a way, because I mentioned in the introduction that, I guess one of the most sort of surprising recurring subjects of conversation or in the monologue is sort of sex robots or sort of sex machines. And I guess one of the ways that people sort of generally set up this kind of dichotomy between sort of, you know, the sex robots and the kind of the sort of the emotional sort of empathetic connection of sort of two people sort of making love, I guess, a term which actually your narrator takes issue with in the book as well. But that's not the sort of dichotomy that she sets up, because with Kay, there is something that she kind of appreciates about the kind of the mechanical way, at least at the start of their relationship, that both of them sort of approach sex.
Well, I think with Kay, she sort of deliberately goes for a man who's not really available because he's married, he's got children. So there is this sort of boundary there from the beginning. But I think she's quite lonely. And I think mm-hmm. She realizes that comfort is something quite dangerous, or a certain kind of comfort that... that we seem to seek, or that we're meant to be seeking, is, I think, quite, you know, I find it quite problematic. There is the German philosopher Simmel, he once said, comfort isolates. And I think it's very true that being too comfortable can make us quite lonely. Mm-hmm. And so I think she, even though somehow she's not really capable, I think, of being in a sort of conventional relationship, I think she still tries, because I think even in a sort of mechanical situation like this, you will have a reaction, and mm-hmm. it's still another person, and you sort of have to engage with that. And of course, with Kay, it all goes wrong, because he doesn't treat it as a, or towards the end, he doesn't treat it as a mechanical situation. And I think there is something good about losing comfort. I mean, even at the moment, this is not sex robots, but this is because, you know, on this like beautiful island where I live, we don't really have petrol at the moment. Mm-hmm. And which of course has nothing to do with Brexit. And and you can't just take an Uber anymore, for instance. Mm-hmm. It's either very expensive or they just don't come, and you have to take public transport again. Mm-hmm. Which I think in some ways is maybe a good experience, you know. I think sometimes losing comfort can be a good thing. And I'm always wary of being too comfortable. And I think the sex robot, apart from the fact, of course, that they are, I think, usually built for men. I'm not mm-hmm. sure there are. That's her dream, of course, is to get this sex robot sort of made for her. But I think she is, just like she's sort of not talking into a void, she's talking to Dr. Seligman. I think she's also aware of the fact that you need other people, I think. Mm-hmm. Twisted as she is, I think she still knows, and she's scared of loneliness, as mm-hmm. I think we all are.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's one of the sort of the necessary conditions of a sort of a monologue which takes place over a few hours in one space between two people. Like, it's sort of, things are never going to be entirely resolved. Mm-hmm. But I also think that often it's a kind of the novelist's tendency to tie up as many loose ends as possible, to let the reader leave with a certain sense of an arc being complete, or, you know, loose ends being tied together, at least as much as possible. And one of the things I think is perhaps the bravest thing about The Appointment is that you don't do that. I mean, you said earlier, like, this surgical intervention that she's undergoing, like, we don't come to the end of it. We don't see the result it has. We don't see the effect it has on her life. We don't see the outcome of so many of the strands of stories that she exposes during this kind of limited period of time. So I think, just to finish today, one thing that I'm curious about is, has the story continued for you?
I think I always knew that with a voice like this, it has to be quite a short piece. Now, you can't do this over 300 pages, because people will, I think, right? It's the sort of, it's asking to be quite a short book. I could have written more. I mean, I loved writing that voice, and I sort of had to, I think, stop myself from, you know, overdoing it. And she's still present for me. I like to think that she's in a happier place in some ways, a more liberated place. But I'm not going to write Dr. Seligman's voice. People have asked me to do it, but I'm...
the response
and I do think that a lot of things in life are an open wound, right? They're mm-hmm. never gonna be resolved, and it's something that we create artificially in certain formats, which I think is one reason why the crime format is so popular, because it gives you this sense that things are resolved and there's a solution, even though solution is a bit of a dark word, but, you know, there's like things make sense in the end, but I think mm-hmm. usually they don't.
Well, Katerina, that is all we've got time for. The Appointment is, of course, available from Shakespeare and Company, both in-store and online. It's also, of course, available from your local independent bookstore, wherever that may be, and in more or less whichever language you would like to read it at the moment. It's such an astonishing, liberating, funny, exciting, radical book. I hope that's come across to our listeners in the conversation. I'm sure it has. But all that remains for me to say is, Katerina Volkmer, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thank you so much. This has been great.
Thanks for listening to the Shakespeare & Company podcast with me, Adam Biles. Since you've made it this far, I hope that means you've enjoyed what you've heard and will consider rating us in whatever app you're using. The theme music is Mr. Ginger by the incredible jazz musician Alex Fryman, taken from his album Play It Gentle. I'll be back next week. Until then, take care, happy reading, and thanks again for listening.